I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. Back in the 1990s, Rough House Records in Philadelphia helped to launch the careers of Schoolie D, Nas, the Fugees, Criss Cross, Cypress Hill, and other artists. Chris Schwartz founded Rough House and has written a memoir called Rough House, From the Streets of Philly to the Top of the 90s Hip-Hop Charts, about how he was able to navigate the music business and recognize talent. When Columbia Records called the miseducation of Lauryn Hill very, very, very mediocre, he knew they were wrong. It turns out he was right. It was the first hip-hop record to get a Grammy for Album of the Year. This was in 1998. Schwartz also writes about how his older brothers terrorized him when they were growing up in the Philadelphia suburbs, and about how being in the Navy and later having his hopes dashed about being a musician led to his successful career promoting other people's careers. Chris Schwartz joins us on Radio Times to talk about his life inside and outside the music world, and nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you, Marty, for having me.
You're very welcome. We've got lots of music queued up, and I do want to get to the music, but I also want to start where you start, which is being a kid, one of 10 kids growing up in Devon outside of Philadelphia, and being frankly brutalized and terrorized by your older brothers George, Kevin, and John. Why you?
Well, my family, there's seven boys. There's another older brother, but he was one of my favorite brothers, actually, and I have two younger brothers as well. We were a, you know, German, Irish, Catholic, rowdy, you know, football family, you know, and I was never one for sports, you know, and I think that there was, you know, my father was a furniture salesman who spent a good deal of time on the road. He had accounts all throughout the Northeast and the Mid-Atlantic. So he would leave early in the morning and not come home most of the time till very late at night. And my mother was, you know, incapacitated because, you know, my family was made up almost like as like two groups of kids. And
the older group and the younger group.
The older group and the younger group. So it was almost like the older group were really like, I felt like they were step siblings, you know. And so my father's gone all day. My mother, you know, by the time the younger group of kids were of school age, she had, you know, had really had become, you know, a serious drinker. And she was they gave her all sorts of sedatives and prescribed her, you know, Thorazine and all that stuff.
Wow.
So she was usually in like a diminished capacity. So that kind of left a this sort of like Lord of the Flies dynamic within the family. And so there were some, you know, some of my elder siblings took advantage of this. And you know, I probably didn't realize at the time, but I think the reason that I was targeted because, you know, I just wasn't like a football.
A jock,
you know?
like them.
I wasn't a jock, yeah.
Well, you describe early on, you're 8 years old, and you ended up in a body cast.
Right.
I mean, you don't end up in a body cast unless you're seriously injured, and
right.
It took you about a year before you could walk again.
Yeah. Yeah, it was that was pretty brutal, and it was passed off as that we were playing football. We weren't playing football, you know, and it was, you know,
it was frightening.
Typical. Yeah, very frightening.
Well, and I don't want to belabor this, but you write about one of your brothers, Kevin. You said if he wanted a glass of milk while watching TV, he expected it to be brought to him. We did his laundry. We cleaned his room, washed his car. We were there to serve his every need under the threat of violence. We were not allowed to talk in his presence. We sat there at the dinner table in frightened silence while he glowered. He enjoyed watching us react in fear, particularly when he raised his hand and pretended to strike us. So here you are, a little boy.
Right.
In this family, as you said, your dad's on the road. Your mom is incapacitated. In fact, you write, incapable of doing anything for us. So
right.
You were on your own to defend yourself.
Right. Right. And, you know, they were pretty, you know, these were guys that were always out fighting everybody in the streets, you know. And so they met it out you know, what they considered, you know, for like my next oldest brother, John, the youngest of the older brothers, there was always something with him because he was the youngest of the older brothers. So he was, I guess, for him, in this weird place. But, he, you know, he had like a lot of anger, a lot of anger.
Clearly.
And it didn't take much. And he, it was always like these imagined slights, you know. And he, and as I said in the book, he was the one I never wanted to be alone in the house with. Because he, you know, if to taking a beating from George or Kevin was one thing, because, you know, they're just, they're beating on you, like a typical beating. But John was a little bit different. He was more like he was in it for keeps. And, you know, it's pretty.
It was hard to read, I have to say. I mean,
well, it was hard to write. And in my publishers, you know, they, you know, the original title of the book was called Smash.
Yeah.
Because it was that, it was a double meaning. It was like, you know, hit record and broken bones. So I figured it was a good title for, and, but they told me that I kind of needed to chill out on that part of it. Only, and then I had read in my research and, you know, writing a memoir that if there was something unpleasant that you've experienced in your life and it's important to the story, you should obviously write about it, but you shouldn't belabor it and go on all throughout the book. So I pretty much kept all that to the first chapter, although I was one book reviewer that thought for some reason that wasn't a good idea, and I should have kept going back to it later in the story. I don't know why. But,
well, you're not going to please everybody.
Yeah.
You do describe, though, staying away from the house as much
right.
as you can, but you also describe the music, whether it was WFIL or
right.
WMMR here in Philadelphia, that music was an escape for you in many ways.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, well, it was the only thing I had, you know. And I, some of my earliest memories, you know, as a child, like literally going back to a toddler, I remember songs like Downtown and Georgie Girl and
oh my
everything.
Gosh.
And these
you're dating yourself there.
Yeah, I know. And these big pop radio songs. And, you know, the thing about, like, you know, AM radio back in, like, the 60s and 70s, it was actually a lot cooler than people would really imagine it to be, you know. And case in point was that a group that I was really into, you know, also was Kraftwerk. And Kraftwerk had a song called Autobahn, which was the song that made them famous. And it was like 22 minutes long, and they would play it.
Well, we're not going to play that song, but we're going to play Kraftwerk, a Trans-Europe Express. This is from Kraftwerk, 1977, and this was music that was very important to you, Chris Schwartz. Let's give it a listen.
Trans-Europe Express.
Kraftwerk, Trans-Europe Express. And Chris Schwartz was saying while we were listening to that, that this was really a breakdance anthem. Kraftwerk, a German group.
Right.
And
right.
very influential, not to you, but also to a lot of other people.
Right. Well, it's I was listening to that, to those records when I was in my, you know, like 70, 74, 75. Mm-hmm. And that particular record was redone by a artist called Afrika Bambaataa and Soul Sonic Force, produced by a gentleman by the name of Arthur Baker. Mm. And they took that song and they reworked it, and it was a like a breakdance anthem. And because it in, you know, the early days of, you know, what people want to call hip hop or rap in the early days, in the late 70s, early 80s, there was really, and you know, it's funny, Questlove had pointed this out to me, is that there was really about
of the roots,
a half hour, a half hour of music, right? And because you had the groups like all the Sugar Hill stuff and everything, and, but the rest of it was all more electronic techno like that.
Well, let me squeeze in one more song. This has nothing to do with Kraftwerk or with pop music, but you're a Frank Zappa fan,
yes,
as I am.
Yes, yes.
So we're going to play just a bit of Inca Roads, and this is from Frank Zappa from his 1975 album called One Size Fits All.
Yeah.
Inca Roads by Frank Zappa and Chris Schwartz. Why Frank Zappa? Why was he important to you as a musician?
It was, a lot of it had to do with the arrangements. You know, I was really into the kind of the complexity of it. I like the, you know, the different time signatures, and I love the guitar playing.
Yeah,
and I was, you know, I come from the school of, you know, Zappa, Hendrix, and Garcia. To me, those were the, you know, the guitar players, you know, and it just, everything from his orchestrations, and, you know, a lot of my friends like kind of like the goofy songs, you know, with the singing, the stuff from like Don't Eat Yellow Sun, all that stuff, right. You know, I didn't really, you know, I was more into like the track we just heard.
Me too.
That whole album is phenomenal.
It certainly is. We're going to take a very short break and then get back to our conversation. Our guest is Chris Schwartz. He's got a new book, brand new book. It's a memoir called Rough House, From the Streets of Philly to the Top of the 90s Hip Hop Charts. He founded Rough House Records. You can join our conversation. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and tweet us at @WHYYRadioTimes.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscone, talking with Chris Schwartz. He grew up in the Philadelphia area. Frankly, had all the ingredients to become successful in the music industry, an eye for talent, an ear for music, a head for business. His record label, Rough House Records, instrumental in the rise of some of the biggest names in 90s hip hop. And we'll be playing some of that music as well. I do want to just finish a piece of your story before we even get to the music, which is you, at the age of 17, you joined the Navy.
Right.
In part, it sounds like, to get away from your family, but also it was in the Navy that you really, sounds like, you found yourself.
I did. Because when I left home at 17, I basically... You know, I didn't tell anybody what I was doing. You know,
you just left.
One of my sisters knew, you know, and they told everybody, you know, because I was able, you know, when you're, you need to get it signed by your parents too. And it was very, you know, my mother, I just got her to sign it while she was passed out. And,
wow.
So Yeah, the Navy. When I got into the Navy and I'm suddenly living in this very large room with 79 other guys, I did kind of realize that I wasn't as messed up as a person as that my family would have had me believing all throughout my life. And the thing,
what a revelation to have.
Yeah. And I was such a music head, you know, that I could talk with anybody with using just music as a common denominator, you know, conversationally. And I just really started to find myself, you know, and then I put some bands together, right. You know, and put a band together, and then I started playing with other musicians, and it was, you know.
What I think your story is so interesting on so many levels, and one is just some people have a game plan. You know, they have, you know, by the time I'm 21, I'm going to do this, and then when I'm 25, I'm going to do that. Your life has been so much about chance and serendipity and being in the right place at the right time.
Right.
Does it feel that way for you?
Yeah, you kind of have to. I never wanted to stop and put too much thought into anything, because if you do, you'll start to find cracks and stuff that are better left unnoticed.
So don't think too much.
Yeah,
right?
don't think too much. Just kind of, you know, the old thing, dive in. Yeah, I don't know whether it's hot or cold, but I'm going to do it anyhow.
Yeah. Well, tell us how you hooked up with Schoolie D.
I got out of the Navy and I went through a series of jobs. I was a chimney sweep. I was a cook. All sorts of things. But at the entire time, though, I wanted to be a musician, and I ended up starting. I was out finding groups and bringing them to the studio up at Broad and Columbia, a place called Virtue Recording to do production.
Right.
And after I did that for about a year, I was still working. I worked at Downey's on South Street. I saw an ad in the paper for a record label in West Philly, answered the ad, and I worked at this little record label at 52nd and Parkside. It was at... on the third floor of this daycare center. And
Nice Town Records, right?
Yes, Nice Town Records. It was a lot of records that nobody really cared about. He had a Bill Cosby Live at Grateford Prison record, go figure.
Yeah.
And Schoolie had come there that morning to talk about having the owner of this company distribute his records, and the owner didn't want to. Now, oddly enough, I had already decided that day I was quitting to start a record label. And I went down to the owner's office, and we're sitting there, and I see these records stacked up against the wall, and it's got the yellow label of like a magic marker, yellow of the rocket ship, and I'm looking at it, and it says song is Gucci Time by Schoolie D. Now, I knew who Schoolie was. I knew the song Gucci Time. And he said, oh, yeah, well, Schoolie wanted us to distribute his records, but, you know, I told him I wasn't interested.
Whoa.
And I'm sitting there.
Light bulb, right? Light bulb.
Yeah.
Moment.
Well, I was kind of in disbelief, because I've been calling retailers and, you know, about this Bill Cosby record, and it was so absurd. And I filched a number later on off of his desk. I called Schoolie up. And we, after, you know, a couple meetings and with his lawyer and everything, I finally, you know, was able to sit down with him. I said, look, I said, you know, you're very, people love you, you know, and they love your records and all that. I said, but, you know, I know manufacturing, distribution, marketing, promotion, all that stuff. And I could help you. I think you should have your own record label.
And he said yes.
Yeah, yeah. And that's kind of like really where the adventure begins.
Well, let's listen to Gucci Time. And this is Philadelphia rapper Schoolie D. This is from actually 1985.
Gucci, it's about that time. The answer's moving to start humming the rhyme. I heard you was out there playing my lines. And if I catch you, boy, your ass is mine. You're always in my face saying, Scoochie, Scoochie, man. How the f*** you get so goofy, man? Never ever seen you play no fool. Cause I use a microphone like a plumber uses a tool. One, two, three, and looking at my Gucci, it's about that time.
So what did you hear there, Chris?
Completely unlike anything else that's come out before it. You have to think hip hop up till then was, it was a lot of like, I don't want to call it like happy rap, but it was very, a lot of gimmicky subjects, you know, a lot of things involving girls and stuff like that. And there was no, he was really like the first, you know, what we call
gangster,
but it wasn't, this is like real gangster. I mean, like, this is, you know, silk shirt, gun in the waistband, alligator shoes, you know, type, not the hip hop gangster that everybody kind of visualizes, you know, with the hockey shirts and, you know, the pants hanging, you know. And the other part of it was really the production too, because that record is there was no other record like it at the time, and some of the production was happenstance due to the fact of where it was recorded and how it was recorded, but unique nonetheless, and unique enough that record basically, you know, bought him worldwide acclaim.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you. That's Chris Schwartz, CEO of Rough House Records. He's got a book, a memoir called Rough House, From the Streets of Philly to the Top of the 90s Hip Hop Charts. We've been talking about how he got into this business, and we'll be playing some more music as well. And you can join our conversation, any questions or comments. That phone number, 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times to join our conversation. Let me introduce Joe. Is it Niccolo into the conversation here?
Yes.
And you and he worked together on a lot of these records, and you talk about how he understood the, quote, dirty drum sound, that there was a certain sound that he seemed to instinctively understand.
He, back in the 80s, what I had found with a lot of studio engineers was that they approached hip hop like they approach anything else, you know, and people, you know, it's almost what he did, I think a lot of engineers would have found counterintuitive. But it's really about knowing what the audience wants and what the audience expects. And, you know, it was funny because a lot of like these hip hop demos in the 80s and everything, they were all, because nobody had the production, you know, to do stuff at their homes and everything. But that doesn't mean that this repertoire wasn't, you know, applicable to what the audience wanted. And I think Joey understood that because he knew most engineers would take like the drum tracks and make them all antiseptic clean and like, you know, and you get like just a really flat, uninteresting sounding record. And he actually not only left them dirty like they would be on like on a demo, but he enhanced it and made it big. And to me, there was really three producers in all of hip hop throughout the 80s that really had this thing down, and Joey was one of them.
Comment from Kate. She says the unique quality about Schoolie D is the believability of his music. Do you agree with that?
Absolutely.
You talk about drums. I don't want to spend a whole lot of time on the Roland TR-808 rhythm composer,
right,
but
yeah.
You write about it.
I do, because it was an important thing. And what was important about it is that it was the first ever programmable drum machine. I had started using it because when I got out of the Navy, I was with a uh, I had a I had a group with my childhood friend Jeff Coulter, and we played electronic music. But that drum machine later on became iconic in the world of hip hop. But that's how, you know, prior to schooling and everything, how we got, you know, I got into it.
Let me talk about Chris Cross.
Right.
These were, what, two 12-year-olds?
Yeah, 11 and 12 at the
11
time.
12-year-olds. How did you find them?
I had a marketing and promotion company. It was a woman named Rose Mann, and she did retail promotion, and another woman named Jackie Paul, who was the rap chart editor for Impact Magazine. And we worked records for other labels because as Schoolie's manager, right, we ended up signing Schoolie with Jive Records, but all the labels that wanted to sign him were coming to me and hiring me to work their hip-hop artists. And we would get them to hire Joe to mix the record. So there was one point where I think we could look at the top 50 hip-hop singles chart in Billboard, and Joe and I each had, you know, probably we were involved in 20 of those records at any given time.
Wow.
So we did a project like that for Geffen Records, and the group was called Silk Times Leather, and they had a producer who was 15 years old. His name was Jermaine Dupri. And Silk Times Leather record didn't really do much, but Jermaine and his father, who was his manager, Michael Malden, had brought Joe and I this demo of this group, and the song was called Little Boys in the Hood. And we did at first a singles deal, then it turned into an EP deal, then it became an album deal, and it was very late in the album production that they did the song Jump,
which we're going to play. This is Jump by Chris Cross, and this is from their 1992 album Totally Crossed Out.
Jump.
Catchy tune there, eh?
yeah, it's a catchy tune.
they would wear their clothes backwards, right?
Yeah,
that
was Jermaine's idea. Jermaine is really the creative, you know, genius behind the whole thing.
And do we know where they are today?
One of them had unfortunately passed away.
Oh, that's too bad.
Yeah. That was Chris Kelly had passed away. He had been sick for a long time, and Chris Smith, he's designing clothing. He still does music. And, you know, they're living down in Atlanta.
Rough House Records. The name actually came from Joe, right? Your partner?
We were sitting in I was telling you about Arthur Mann earlier. We were in Arthur's office, and there was a cassette of a rock band called Rough House, R-O-U-G-H. And Joe picked it up, and he said, that would be a great name for the record label. And I agreed, but I said, we can't spell it R-O-U-G-H. It has to be spelled R-U-F-F.
And
there it is, yeah.
You know, I don't want to make too big a deal about this, but it's hard not to make a connection to the quote-unquote roughhousing that you had to endure as a kid. And I say roughhousing in quotations in that it wasn't roughhousing.
I know. When we came up with the name, I don't know how much of my childhood at that point that I had shared with Joe.
Yeah.
I think I may have mentioned, because it's kind of hard to tell people about it, because it's not the type of thing you could just, you know, just toss out in like a 10-minute conversation. You really have to get the whole scene, the whole, you know, the backdrop and everything that you know, about my parents and everything. So, it is a little bit maybe coincidence, but I did grow up in a rough house.
Yeah.
And the label is called Rough House. It may have been subliminal. So.
Is your family able to enjoy? Were they able to enjoy your success?
Some of them were.
How about your brothers?
Even after I was, you know, phenomenally successful and it was obvious to the world, I think some of them still just didn't want to accept it, and they took every chance they could to take, you know, shots at me, you know.
Is that still true today, or is this?
I don't really talk to some of them
that
much, especially since the book, because one of them had texted me and he had said, quote unquote, "Why did you make up all those lies about me?" in his text. And I said, "Okay, well, tell me which thing I lied about." No response. And then he said, "Well, why didn't you mention about when you set the house on fire?" Well, yeah, I did set the house on fire when I was 3 years old playing with matches. You know, so.
We have to take a very short break, right, and we'll get back to our conversation again. Chris Schwartz, CEO of Rough House Records, is our guest. His new book is called Rough House. Much more after the short break. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowane talking with Chris Schwartz. He was CEO of Rough House Records during the 90s and, again, author of a new book called Rough House, From the Streets of Philly to the Top of the 90s Hip-Hop Charts. He's now the CEO of Rough Nation. Here's a tweet from Del P. Major shout-out to Chris Schwartz for giving me an opportunity I've worked for my whole life. You're smiling broadly.
Yeah, Del's a good guy. He's awesome. Mega talent. And, you know, it's a... You know, this company, I have a partner in this company, and it's a woman named Cara DiCarlo, and she, it's amazing, her knowledge of hip hop is just voluminous. I've never met a woman that knew more about hip hop than her, and she actually, Dell is actually her signing.
Oh, interesting. Yeah. Interesting. Let me just also give out the email address for those of you that want to join our conversation. I invite you to do so, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And you can call us at 1-888-477-9499. Let's talk about Cypress Hill. And we're going to play Insane in the Brain from their 1993 album, Black Sunday. How did you hook up with them?
Almost exact same way as Chris. It was a record for Geffen called 783. And, I had met there was an A&R guy. A&R means artist and repertoire, who worked for Geffen Records, and his favorite artists in the world were Schoolie D and another Philadelphia band that I was managing, and I put out a record on called Executive Slacks. And they were kind of like Nine Inch Nails about 15 years before Nine Inch Nails.
Really?
Right? Yeah. Wow. Yeah. His name was Mio Vukovic, and Mio had signed a hip-hop act called 783. The producer for 783 was a gentleman from Brooklyn named Lawrence Muggerud, a.k.a. Muggs, who after the 783 record had hooked up with the two other guys, Sen and B-Real, to form Cypress Hill.
Oh, wow. Another one of those serendipitous stories.
Yes.
Well, let's listen to Insane in the Brain.
I'm thinking it's all over when I go out drinking. Oh, making my mind slow. That's why I don't with the big 4-0. Bro, I got to maintain. Cause it like me is going insane.
Insane in the Brain by Cypress Hill from their 1993 album Black Sunday. So what was it like for you to be sort of in this juggernaut, as you described, this juggernaut of hip-hop music in the 1990s?
Oh, it was, well, it was exciting. you never knew what each day was going to bring. Because what happened really was that, you know, a lot of people don't realize, you know, the 90s were the most profitable decade in the history of music. And so you had two things happening. You had albums, right, that we had throughout all of going up to, you know, the 80s. And the CD came out in the 80s, but it really didn't come into full fruition till the 90s. So you had two elements happening. You had CDs, which cost 67 cents to make the CD, the jewel case, the gatefold pull-out with the four-color separation, right? And you're selling it for $16.99, $17.99, and you're spending $3 to $4 to market and promote it. So you look at that profit margin. So you have that over here. And over here, you have the immense popularity of hip-hop. So the CD with the huge profit margins and the hip hop audience like voluminous, ravenous, and astoundingly, you know, active consumers, active record buyers, active ticket buyers, everything. And it was like the perfect storm.
What'd you do with all that money?
a lot of really genius things I did. Yeah.
Genius meaning?
Genius. Yeah. I'd rather not get into it.
Okay. An email from Glenn.
I know. I did some really stupid things.
But. Yeah. And you had a drug problem.
Yeah. I was a diminished capacity. Yeah.
Right. And you've been sober for how long now?
Going on, I guess, about, let's see. I want to say 15 years.
Good for you. Yeah. It's a big deal.
Yeah.
To do that. Here's an email from Glenn. I worked for Chris for many years, and it was really his grit and determination despite whatever obstacles that made him and Joe Niccolo the force that they were. Be sure to point out that Rolling Stone magazine named Rough House Record Label of the Year.
Right. Yep. Thank you, Glenn.
Let's talk about the Fugees, and you say
that was Glenn Manco. He was our publicist.
Oh, excellent!
Very good. See, he's still working
doing
for
it.
Us, right?
He made me say the words, right? Well, let's talk about the Fugees, and you say by the time you met them and began working with them, that you were really bored by hip hop. What did they have?
Here's what it was. I wasn't, and maybe I should have said that a better way. I wasn't bored with hip hop. What I was bored with was going to see hip-hop live, because hip-hop live up to that point was you would have MC Mashed Potato and DJ Gravy Boat, right, performing, and, you know, the DJ and the MC, and they're just standing there and rapping, not moving. And then some groups started having, like, dancers to try and, you know, distract the audience. But it's, you know, like Schoolie D, right? We took a live band out with him, like in the 80s, and a group from Philly, they're a ska group called Scram. And he toured with like Fishbone and Big Audio Dynamite. And there was always like, you know, just some element live of something exciting happening. And I'd go to see a lot of hip hop groups, and I don't want to name any, but there was just some who were like groups that sold a lot of records, but you go see them, and it was just really a very pedestrian affair. So when we went to see the Fugees audition, there was a gaggle of them.
Yeah.
You know, it was like, I remember about these seven or eight people. And Wyclef was sort of like the de facto leader. He was like the center of attention. But he had an acoustic guitar and he had a boombox. Now, you know, I didn't know he was from Haiti at the time. And I thought he was like Jamaican or, you know, like some from the West Indies. You know, I wasn't sure. But I know this, that the acoustic guitar in Caribbean island culture is a very important thing, right? And so he had an acoustic guitar and he could play it, right? Then he's a young man from North Jersey, New York, you know, in coming from the hip hop generation. So you have those two kind of like influences, and together it was like, you know, like Bob Marley over a drum loop, you know. It was just really, really nice. It was just really tasty thing. And I would, like, literally within 45 seconds, I knew I wanted to work with him.
Wow.
And I knew Joe did too.
Well, let's listen to Ready or Not by the Fugees, and again from their 1996 album called The Score.
Ready or not, here I come, you can't hide. Gonna find you and take it slowly. Ready or not, here I come, you can't hide. Gonna find you and make you want.
Now that I escape, sleep, walk, awake.
Yeah.
Those who come late know the world ain't kick. Jail bars ain't golden gates. Those who fake, they break. When they meet their 400-pound mate, if I could rule the world, everyone would have a gun in the ghetto, of course. We get the up and on their horse. Kick a rhyme, drinking moonshine. I pour a sip on the concrete for the deceased, but no, don't weep. Why Clef's in a state of sleep, thinking about the robbery that I did last week. Money in the bag, banker look like a drag. I wanna play with pelicans from here to Baghdad. Gun blast, think fast, I think I'm hit. My girl pinched my hips to see if I still exist. I think not, I'll send a letter to my friends. A born again hooligan, only to be king again.
Ready or not, here I come, you can't hide. Gonna find you and take it slow.
That song's more than 20 years old, and it really holds up, doesn't it?
It never gets old. It never gets old. It's a classic song.
I was watching you listening. What were you listening to as you were listening to them?
I was listening to them. I'm listening to her and him. You know, I'm listening to them. You know, we did this really spectacular video for it at the time. I think we spent almost like $3 million for the video.
And wow.
That was, you know, we kind of set the bar. I mean, the record was massive. It was a massive, massive record. So it didn't really, you know, it warranted it. And I always think about the submarine because we shot the submarine at three different places. It was Fox, Paramount, and Warner's. And at Paramount, they had a shell in a process lake with a horizon, you know. And then I think it was at Fox is where they had an actual World War II submarine, but it was cut into sections so you could film the interiors.
Oh my god!
And so every time I hear that, I think about them singing it inside that submarine interior.
That's quite an image.
Yeah.
Let me play Doo-Wop. It's also known as that thing from Lauryn Hill's 1998 album, The Miseducation of Lauryn Hill, that Columbia Records, I quoted in my introduction, thought was very, very, very mediocre, went on to win a Grammy for Album of the Year. Let's give it a listen.
With his rims and his Timbs and his women, him and his men, come in the club like hooligans. Don't care who they your friend, Poppy Yang.
Like you got yeah.
Let's not pretend. The one in the pack pissed out by the waistman, crissed out by the casement. Still the name of his basement. The pretty face man claiming that they did a bid, man. Need to take care of their 3 and 4 kids. Been the face in court case when the child support's late. Money taking, heartbreaking. Now you wonder why women hate men. The sneaky silent man, the punk domestic violence man, the quick to shoot the semen. Stop acting like boys and be men. How you gonna win when you ain't right within? How you gonna win when you ain't right within? How you gonna win when you ain't right within? Come again.
So, Chris, you clearly knew something that Columbia Records didn't know.
Well, I mean, it's if you looked at the success of the score, and I think what it is that they, because Wyclef had done a lot of production for people, right? And so I think they had trouble reconciling themselves to the fact that she was going to make a record on her own, you know. And the thing is, though, she's been in front of a TV camera since she was like a little girl. So she's not new to entertainment, you know. And the songs were undeniably great, you know. But the thing is, I didn't really go too much into it in the book, but they didn't like Wyclef's record on first listen. And I was, you know, how could you not like that? So, yeah, it was odd, but
it worked.
It worked, yeah.
Well, Chris Schwartz, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Marty.
Radio Times.
This has been great.
Great for us as well. Lots of good music. CEO of Rough House Records, now the CEO of Rough Nation. And he's got a new book called Rough House, From the Streets of Philly to the Top of the 90s Hip Hop Charts. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes to find out more about the program. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen. I'm Marty Moscoen, and we want to close things out with Killing Me Softly by the Fugees from their 1996 album called The Score.
I know you got the lyrics.
I heard he sang a good song. I heard he had a style. And so I came to see him and listen for a while. And there he was, this young boy, stranger to me.